Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Arkham Files, usually your actual play Call of Cthulhu RPG podcast, but today we are bringing you another awesome edition of our Arkham Files dossiers, our interview series where we sit down and have cool conversations with interesting people from the gaming and geekdom world. Our very special guest for today hails from the swamps and pine forests of East Texas. He is a two-time Gold Annie Award winner, and is currently nominated for a third. As a game master with decades of experience under his belt, he has a successful YouTube channel where he gives out entertaining and insightful reviews, advice, and philosophy on gaming. He is also the accomplished author of the popular Valdakin and Black Raven series of stories. His latest novel, Ashes of Onyx, which especially should appeal to our fans of the mythos, has been hailed by Publishers Weekly as a wildly imaginative, magical thrill ride. I am, of course, talking about author, game master, and self-proclaimed lover of nerdly things, Seth Skorkowski. Seth, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. That's one hell of an intro. I sound way more cool than I am.
Well, you're definitely more cool than us, and so...
That's true. So,
just to kick things off, we mentioned some of your projects in the opener, obviously, but... Can you tell us a little bit more about what brought you to where you are today? How did you get introduced to the world of tabletop gaming? And can you think of any significant experiences earlier in your life that ignited your passion for it?
Well, I've always been a fan of, you know, sci-fi fantasy genre fiction. So, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I loved watching stuff like Thundar the Barbarian and you know, basically all the really cool 80s cartoons because it was just a lot of fantasy then. I found out about D&D through the Satanic Panic, and when they released the black box edition right before my 13th birthday, I had to have it because I had always heard about D&D and I wanted to see what this devil game was about. So I got that when I was 13. Shortly after, I managed to find a friend whose dad had been running since the 70s, so he started us with advanced Dungeons and Dragons, way cooler than my, you know, evidently basic D&D. And but that was all first edition, because he's like, I'm not buying this brand new second edition stuff. So I ended up hooking up with them real quickly after I got into D&D, and that's kind of where it started. And then a couple of years later, I discovered Cyberpunk 2020, because I was, you know, it's into my punk rock phase. So I was like, hey, this book's got punk on it. And then that kind of one thing led to another. And that's pretty much it.
Awesome. That's cool. Another thing, obviously, you're an author of, you know, fantasy and books. Tell us some of your favorite authors and authors that influence or inspire you.
You know, when I was young in high school, Clive Barker became one of my biggest influences. I read everything by Barker, and he was pretty instrumental in kind of crafting what my style was going to be like. And then I got into Fritz Leiber's Fafhrenn and Grey Mauser series because of D&D. There was like the Lenkmar City of Adventure, which had that gorgeous cover on it, and I had to know what that was about. So I ended up picking that up, which then got me into Leiber, which got me into Sword and Sorcery. Of course, you know, the ubiquitous seventh grade, read The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings shortly after, sort of thing. But I really gravitated more to the Sword and Sorcery, and then of course Barker-esque, which he's really known for his horror, which that's actually all his short fiction. His novels are more like urban fantasy or portal fantasy, which, I mean, yeah, he'll lean into the violent and the horrific, but he's mostly a fantasy author that just has some really dark stuff. A lot more like Neil Gaiman, I think, than people realize. Kind of a little, kind of an R-rated Neil Gaiman, PG-13 Neil Gaiman is the one we call Neil. So that was probably pretty big influences. After that, William Gibson was a really big one. And after that, just a little bit of here and there.
Cool. Do you remember like a specific point where you decided like, hey, I want to be a writer, like writing fiction is something that I want to do? Was there something in, you know, in your childhood or whatever, where you had this aha moment where it's like, hey, this is something I really love and something I really want to do?
I had that actually very young. I remember telling my mom about the first time I wanted to write a book when I was in third grade. And then, you know, by eighth grade, I was winning creative writing contests and whatnot. But then when high school rolled around, I ended up joining the debate team and getting into public speaking. And everybody said I should get into broadcasting because I got a good radio voice. So I kind of left writing and I did that. And then I went to college and I got a radio, TV, film degree. And about the time I graduated, I realized there was absolutely no money in radio. And it kind of quickly jumped into a corporate job after graduating. And because I'd moved away from all my friends and all of that, I had like all that time on my hands that I used to be hanging out with them. I decided to start writing. And that's really where it became a serious thing. So I guess it was, you know, my early 20s is when that became an actual kind of a big part of my life again. Because in between those points, it was pretty much, you know, D&D and cyberpunk and all that I was playing is what I was using as that creative outlet for kind of crafting stories and different things. But once I had a lot more time on my hands, it suddenly became, let's write some stories.
Cool.
Very cool.
So kind of transitioning, writing fiction, and I'm trying not to get too much into that. I'm a huge fiction nerd, and so I could just probably spend the entire time asking you questions about that, and then
he's a huge nerd.
But getting into you know, the podcast and the gaming realm, one of the things you do on your channel is you review scenarios and adventures. And you've also obviously published your own. Do you have any tips or advice on pitfalls you'd avoid when it comes to writing, you know, for people who want to write and publish their own scenarios? When you're reviewing a scenario, what are things that stand out to you as either really, really cool or something where you're like, oh, this is, you know, this is a common mistake?
Man, we could go about this for a long time. The first ones that jump to my mind are first that anything that the characters, the players are supposed to do, there is a reason that they would decide to do that. You should never have moments where you're like, and then they do this. Like, no, we have to have a motivation behind every single thing that they're supposed to do, whether it be, you know, this clue leads to here, or at this point they're expected to help the villagers, you know, whatever it is, we need to actually have motivation sown throughout. The next thing is, when you're writing an adventure module for a game master, it's a lot like writing a recipe. You are giving the game master like the instructions on how to have this adventure sort of thing, which means you need to say up front who the bad guy is, what we're expected to do throughout this, what the twist is. Like, don't hold back where the game master has to be halfway through to get to the reveal of who the hell the bad guy is, because you're not writing this to entertain the game master. You're writing this to be like, hey, this is going to be a mystery and there's this many characters and all the stuff's going on. Here's the backstory. Give it to them all up front. I've read a lot of scenarios where when I do need to reference something out of the backstory, something like that, it's scattered throughout the whole thing. And it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be written like a story. It needs to be written more like a recipe. And the game master's the chef. They're cooking this for all their players. You need to make this as easy to run from as possible, which doesn't necessarily mean it's the most fun to just sit and read. It's supposed to be fun to play. And I think that's one of the other big ones that I would tell a new author is, don't write it out like a story.
Cool. No, that's awesome. I love that. Recipe is a great way to put it. I'm kind of bogarting the conversation. Donovan, do you want to jump in and ask a question?
No, I do not.
Okay.
No, I'm just joking. Yeah, I can ask a question. Yeah, well, on the other side of it, you give tips on for GMs on how to run games effectively. What is something you've learned and how hard, in the hard way, not to do? Do you have any examples or stories or scenarios that you could share, or something you tried to do in a game where you're running it and it just crashed and burned on you?
Oh, God. I've got tons of them.
You only have, 25 years of... You have 25 years of experience. I need you to whittle that down to one example, okay?
Okay. Well, like I was talking about with modules, like there's the part where like, and then they do this because, no reason given. And then, of course, the players, they don't know where they're supposed to go. They don't have any direction. They don't have any motivation for anything. And all of a sudden, I'm frantically trying to steer them. I'm basically trying to railroad them at this point, because I haven't given them a reason to want to do the thing or even know that they should do the thing. I'm just like, well, you're going to do it because you're supposed to, right? Like I've written a story in my head, and now the players are going to do it like following a script of what it is. And then all of a sudden I'm resisting the fact that they have free will. Because when you're writing a novel or whatnot, your characters will turn the right direction. They will decide to go to the place where the thing is, because, you know, you're making them up. They'll do whatever the hell you want to, for whatever reason you want to give them to do it. But with your players, you have to do that. I didn't. And it took me way too long to really figure that one out. Cause like, you learn your lesson and you're like, oh, okay, I got this. And you know, couple weeks, couple months later, all of a sudden it happens again. You're like, Oh yeah. I forgot. You guys are supposed to have motivation and free will. And yeah. So that's one of my many, many hard lessons.
Well, I was actually watching a bunch of your videos on your seven deadly sins of GMs, and it sounds like you have quite a bit for the players as well. But I think there's four videos you have out there. Is that right? So like it's like 28 deadly sins that GMs just can't do. Like, which one of those do you have to sacrifice most often when you play games? Or when you're like, in a scenario?
Like, which sin do I have to like commit the most,
you have these things you're asked not, you're like, don't do this when you're playing a game. Do you find yourself having to go back and break those rules?
Never on purpose, because these are things that like I've learned not to do. The ones though that I do wrestle with, is it's what I call the loot fairy. I love giving out the cool item. I love giving them all the cool stuff. And I have screwed myself over and over and over again, because also it's like, man, it'd be really cool if I got on this, you know, a plasma rifle with a 40 watt range or whatever it is. And all of a sudden it's like, ah, crap. You know, they've got this freaking plasma rifle now, and you know, everything's thrown out of whack, or just different things where I, you know, I was like, I wanted to give it to him because it was cool. And now I'm kind of stuck with it. So I have fallen into that one a whole lot. And that is one that I usually find myself doing still to this day, because
that's a good one.
I don't see it before it happens.
I would like to play with you if I could, because that sounds awesome.
Donovan is our guy who steals all the loot, and so if you talk about the loot fairy, he's the loot like recipient. If there's loot to be had, he will fight all the rest of us to get it.
This is true. It's a common mistake Alex makes as well, our main DM. He'll allow us just to have, we'll roll a d6 for how many dynamite we have, and we'll get like six on it, and then it just,
we always seem to roll epic. It's like the quote from Jurassic Park, where you're so preoccupied with whether or not you could, you don't stop to think if you should.
Yeah, I came from first edition AD&D, and in that, if you got fireballed, you actually had, if you failed your save with it, you had to roll for all your stuff. So like when your wizard went crazy and they cast their fireball and the room wasn't big enough and it expanded out to its full volume and it hit everybody. Yeah, you know, it was basically like, okay, well, your sword melts and your left boot catches on fire, and you know, your pants are gone, and your potion's boiled away, and yada yada yada. And but kind of how I made up for that is because then once you get to the next room, I'm going to give you even more cool stuff. So that was kind of how I used to cycle through it. Because players, of course, would be upset, like, oh no, my Vorpal sword melted. Like, don't worry, buddy, I got another one in the next room. Just stop whining and open the door. So then when that stopped like being a thing in games, because I guess people didn't like losing their stuff, I was still just throwing out magic items as if I was constantly removing and replenishing and removing and replenishing. I was just stockpiling at this point. That's when I got in a lot of trouble.
All right. So shifting gears a little bit, as we mentioned, we're primarily a Call of Cthulhu podcast. Shifting over to that, you play a lot of games, obviously, but I just want to ask you, what about Call of Cthulhu specifically do you like, and what do you enjoy about it that makes it different from other games?
I enjoy the horror aspect for one, but mostly I enjoy the investigation aspect. I prefer running a mystery any day over like a hack and slash sort of dungeon crawl. I've been there, I've done that. I burned out on it years and years ago. So having adventures that are kind of these elaborate mysteries where the players are the ones that have to kind of put together the clues and figure out what it means and whatnot is something I love. I enjoy, or I prefer, games where that have a fragility to them. I don't like the way that, you know, like, you know, D&D characters get a certain level, they've got 100 and something hit points, they're just about impossible to actually threaten. They're either basically all in or all out, because, you know, if they've got one hit point, they can still cast all the healings and boom, 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 they're right back to normal. I like characters that have like one hit will take you down and you're not healing quickly. So you better play safe. You better play smart. You know, you better not, you know, just take flippant risks. And so I enjoy that. I love the skill-based system to it. I think it's with 7th edition is so clean. There's no math. It's like, okay, make a regular or hard or extreme success. Maybe we do a bonus or penalty die for whatever reason. But there's no like, I roll the die and I add this number, then I add this modifier, and I've got to, you know, hit this target number. It's just, give me a regular success, roll it. Numbers are all written on the character sheet, smooth. And we can actually just focus on the game. So that's the big things I love with it. But mostly I enjoy the types of story-based adventures that you have with it. It's one of the reasons, like, you know, I'm a loot fairy, but I also don't give a damn about like money in games. Like it is like the most boring thing in the world to me. So I remember when I first read it, I was like, oh great, they can start off rich. I don't have to listen to them like nickel and dime me. Yeah, you know, where it's like, okay, you guys are wealthy, so therefore we don't care about money anymore, right? And
yeah, you don't spend an hour in an item shop while they, you know, haggle with the shopkeeper or try to steal, you know, various things.
Oh yeah, I've got this so much disposable income for day, and we don't even have to keep track of it. It was like, oh my god, it's like the best thing ever.
I think the funniest thing with running Call of Cthulhu game with people who are used to D&D is that you mentioned the fragility of the character, because they're so used to just going in and trying to, you know, bash your way through things. But your character is your investigator dies if you misstep even once. You've got 10 hit points and, you know, you get shot, it takes off 12, you're dead. So that's always a fun realization with people who aren't new to gaming but are new to Call of Cthulhu.
Did that happen to you, Pete?
I don't want to talk about it, Donovan.
Yeah, one thing that's cool to me, like the difference, like it's easy to play D&D kind of like you'd play a video game where, you know, like you can just roll in and go into this room and you don't really worry that much about it. But like with Call of Cthulhu, it feels a lot more like closer to home, like realistic, you know, because it takes place in like the real world. And like when I play it, like I try to imagine like if I were this real investigator and it's really me in this scenario, you know, what would I do?
No, and I think that's part of what also helps keep it grounded, because, you know, we learned the fragility of characters when we played Cyberpunk. There's always the first characters are not going to last long if you're taking like somebody straight over from like D&D, because, you know, they're going to try to like do something crazy that no sane person would actually ever try. And they're just going to kind of casually, you know, jump out of an eighth floor window or something like that, or like, you know, jump in front of the train, whatever. And then you're like, okay, cool. So that was your example character. Now make me one that you will not play like they're a superhero, because, you know, they're not. And I find that sort of it's a little bit more grounded. You know, like you're right, when we're talking about the real world where you can look at a map and you say, it's like, okay, so, you know, we're going to go from here to here. We might have to change the time periods up, but it's not like a world where everything the characters know, they only know from what the game master has told them or being assigned, you know, to read the Forgotten Realms or something. No, if it's going to take place in, you know, the real world, even if it's set in the 30s or the 20s or whatnot, you know, we spend our whole life practicing learning about the real world. You know, we have some basic understandings of a lot of stuff. And that makes it just a lot easier, and you can really focus more on, yeah, the adventure. So, yeah, love it.
That's hilarious, because as you're talking, it's just bringing all these flashbacks to our scenarios. In our last scenario, Sam's character netted a literal net. He netted a car to try to capture me when I was in a daze, and he just mangled himself.
Yeah, it did not work out very well for me.
as it shouldn't.
As it would. If you threw a net around a car, you could let go of the net or you could get dragged by it.
Oh, Sam wasn't having it. Sam was like, no, I'm going to punch you in the face.
So into the kind of the mechanics of the game, but I guess more the feel of the game. One of the things that's challenging with Call of Cthulhu is, or at least it's particularly challenging for us in our show, is kind of that dichotomy of horror and comedy, right? Horror comedy is its own genre, which is, you know, very successful in its own right. But when you're playing a game whose purpose is to have fun, and particularly when you're playing it with friends, it's very easy to let the humor like steal the show and run away, and the horror gets left behind. How do you, as a GM or a keeper of arcane lore, combat that challenge?
I don't. We laugh our butts off. I play with a bunch of old friends. And if I'm doing like a one shot or something and we are going for more of the darker, I usually tell them before, I'm like, hey, we're going to do a little bit darker. But ultimately, you know, we're still going to start cutting up. We're still going to start laughing and joking. And I think the secret is how quickly you can recover from it. Yeah, because you can give a joke and we can all laugh, and then we can recover and get back to it. You know, it doesn't just devolve into zany slapsticks. It's like we play seriously, but at the same time around the table, we're just joking and laughing and being a bunch of dorks. I think that's actually one of the things that a lot of people, when they're trying to look at horror games, like they'll watch live plays and all sorts of stuff, and they don't understand because they want to treat it like they're watching television. If the players are serious and, you know, frightened, we're still dick and fart jokes the whole way, but we recover because we don't play loony. We don't do any of that. And as long as we're still focusing on playing, we're here to have fun, man. So we usually cut up a lot. And that's just how we do it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool. That's kind of the way we go. We try to, because we, our podcast, we go back, I mentioned, we go back and edit. We like to add in like original sound or original music and sound effects, and we try to play up that kind of audio drama as much as possible.
Laugh tracks.
But we definitely don't use laugh tracks. We wouldn't need laugh tracks, for crying out loud. But
we have to cut out the laughing.
And most of the time, we are who we are, and it's going to be a joke, and that's kind of just how we roll.
Well, and I've done several episodes like that, How We Roll podcast. They edit it down. They usually cut out all the joking, which is like, man, that's the best part. Like, I don't remember what else we did. Yeah, but I can remember all the jokes. But then when I've done stuff with Glass Cannon, and we did Call of Cthulhu the first time we did something with them, and a lot of people were upset that we joked, like they were mad. And I remember one guy lecturing me of like, yes, an ambassador to Call of Cthulhu, you should have shown them how the proper way of playing. Like, what are you talking about? We were having fun. We had a great time. And we did a very complicated scenario in 5 hours. We locked down pretty tight. We were joking that we stayed on target the whole time. So, but who cares that we left? That's actually what real games are like.
Well, and I think that points to something that you kind of dwell on in your videos that I really, really like, is essentially when it comes down to it, the purpose of the game is to have fun. Like, if you start the game by saying, hey, I am going to have fun with this regardless of what happens. And when it comes down to it, did your players have fun? Then it was a successful game.
Exactly. And the other aspect to it is, yes, absolutely have fun. But did we get something accomplished? Because I've actually watched a lot of, people who they'll get their group, but they get together and they mostly just have beers and they tell stories and they laugh and they never get anything done in the game. And then they get frustrated because they look back and they actually didn't do anything in the game, but the group ends up falling apart because there still is the aspect of we came together for a purpose. We're going to have this game. We're going to play this game and we're going to have an absolute hoot doing it. So as a game master, sometimes I kind of have to be the horrible draconian just jerk that has to be all like in a clap and like, okay, guys, focus up, back to the game, because we will wander off telling stories and jokes and whatnot. And it still has that focus up. And then we get back to the game and we'll laugh and we'll joke. And then, we have to stay focused on getting the game done, because we're there to have fun and we are there to laugh, but we're also there for a purpose. And I think a lot of people miss that other aspect to it, because I could just hang out with my friends doing anything. So to have a successful game, we still needed to get something done with the game. We still had to play something and, like, you know, do something. But yeah, if it's not fun, then we shouldn't be doing it. Which, yes, we can get frustrated at our dice. We can have all sorts of, you know, the whole range of emotions. But if the overall is not fun, then do something else. Like, that's why we're here.
Yeah. You've mentioned before, you know, you've been GMing for, you know, almost 30 years at this point. You know, it sounds like you're kind of the primary GM for whatever games you play. Do you get to be a regular player very often, or are you mostly the default GM?
With my group, I'm almost always the GM. I've got one player who has been kind of giving us a very off and on Cyberpunk Red game for the past, I guess, about a year now, but it's mostly off and on. And I have another player who has been promising me that he is going to run this campaign and it's going to be awesome. And he's been promising me for, I guess, we're at 20 years now. And one day, I swear, it's going to happen. Yeah, that's about it. And I've ended up being in a lot of other groups with online play, you know, so I've got several that I'm a player and just as a player, but with, you know, with my group and my friends, it's 99% me.
Well, what do you prefer, player or GM?
The ultimate question.
I'm so broken at this point, I have to GM.
It's just too part of who you are. It's just too natural now.
Yeah, I mean, like it's sometimes being a player is just weird as hell. I mean, I still have the need to be a player sometime, but if I had to be one or the other, and that's it forever, I would be GM.
As a being a GM, you know, probably most of the time, is it hard to like switch to being a player and not like play the game as like you're the GM, you know what I mean, where you're thinking of things as a GM would rather than like how a player would?
Which I also see, like being an author, it's real difficult to just read a book anymore without thinking about, you know, how they did a certain sentence structure. Like, oh, that's really good. Or like, oh wow, I can't believe an editor didn't do a pass on this. Or like, oh, that was a really clever twist. Like, so yeah, so you're still kind of talk shop the whole time, even while you're pleasure reading. And the same thing as a player, which you can not always turn that off, but you can turn it down to an ignorable level sometimes. But it is always there, just in the back of how it is, because it's also handy because you see stuff that you could like, oh wow, I like that. Or like, is that a cool trick or whatnot that you can steal ideas from? And then, of course, you know, after it's over, if you are talking to a GM that's kind of asking for your advice afterwards, you can give a proper critique of like, hey, this is what I liked. This is, you know, you had trouble here. This is what I'd recommend you do next time, that sort of thing. But yeah, that voice is always there. It's just the volume is all you can really control, but it's always talking.
Yeah. So one of the things you talk about on your channel is the RPG social contract, which, you know, essentially talks about like what you should do as a player. But on the flip side, as a seasoned GM, like, is there anything that a player could do that will guarantee that they're not invited back to one of your games?
Oh, I've done all of them for sure.
Well, I mean, there's quite a bit, but you know, actually losing their temper is one. If they're very into the mindset, this game is about me, and that they're not really, I don't know, aware of the other people in the room, or they think that those people are there just to watch them, that just becomes exhausting, and they're not usually going to last very long. because I'm a big believer that it is a group effort and everybody there needs to be supporting everyone else and taking everyone else into account. That way everybody gets to have a good time. And when you have a player who just refuses to basically allow anyone else to have a good time, that it's all about them, they are not going to last at my table. As will be if a player comes in with the idea that this is somehow a competition, that I have to beat the game master, or the game master's here to beat me. And they come in with a very antagonistic opinion, where the GM is the enemy. And they have to treat the GM like they're the enemy. And when I've talked about that on various videos, I will inevitably get some people that come on and say, well, the reason they're that way is because they were taught that by a bad game master and it's not their fault. Say, dude, I have taken brand new rookie players off the street who had that mentality. I mean, what are you talking about? Just some people walk in with that mentality, and you can often teach them that's not how it is. It's not antagonistic. I am here to challenge you, but I am not here to defeat you or to, make you miserable. But I'm going to give you a challenge because I want you to win. But I'm going to challenge you so that victory has meaning. And we're going to laugh and we're going to tell jokes the whole time we're doing it. So I think players that still come in with that mentality or refuse to basically be a group instead of just a bunch of individuals are the ones that aren't going to last that long. Because that's where you come across the people steamroll over other people or, so many of the misbehaviors, so many things just come down to the person either on either side of the screen, the thought it was all about them. And many of the problems we talk about really come down to that and communication. Those are basically the two, the two biggest things that cause problems is communication or people that think it's about them.
So when you run a game with new players that you haven't played with before, is it pretty easy to kind of like pick up on what players are going to be like that as the game starts going?
As it starts going, I have realized that it's actually very difficult to judge any of that before you play with them. I have watched people that I thought would be like the greatest role players, like the moment that game starts, like a flip of a switch. And it's like, you spin the wheel. And like, what type of player are you going to be? I can't guess anymore. Just because I've been so terribly wrong so many times with like, well, that didn't work out, or, oh, they surprised me. So after a bit, you could usually do it. And try to steer them with, like, hey, just heads up. Why don't we try these approaches or sort of thing? That way everybody can enjoy it. Because I do know there's a lot of coaching. It's not like anybody's born knowing all this stuff. I certainly didn't. But it also depends on how receptive they are to it.
So one of the things, this is kind of a shift of subject back over to your books. But one of the things that I particularly spoke to me was your blog on your website about the book in the drawer, right? As somebody who is the proud owner also of a book in a drawer, I wondered if you could share that story from your blog with us and with our listeners.
Well, I said I graduated college. I decided to start writing, and I was going to write a big epic fantasy novel because, damn it, that's what you do. And of course, it has to be serious because, damn it, that's what you do. Dad, right. Like any new author that decides to do this, and I'm going to base a lot of it off of our D&D game because, damn it, that's what you're not supposed to do. But a lot of people try. And so I ended up joining, an online writing workshop and, a lot of stuff. And it took me about 2 years to write this novel. And over the course of that time, I learned how to write because I didn't know. And then I started on the sequel. And I got a good way into that while I was trying to pitch the first novel, which pitching is when you have to basically write a one-page letter where you summarize the whole book in 3 to 5 sentences because you're trying to get an agent or an editor to say, oh, send me this, I'll read it, and maybe I'll represent it or maybe I'll publish it. And that had gone nowhere. Like, just just horribly frustrating. And eventually I got guilted by a friend of mine into going to this writing workshop at a convention, because she was involved with the convention and she wanted me to do it. And I basically got pinned and I had to go, but just I was shamed into it. So I did this writing workshop, which is 3 days where you're in basically there's 20 people in a room with an editor. Within everybody shares the first 10 pages of their story. So for the month before, you read the first 10 pages of the 19 other stories. And then you spend 3 days going through it very meticulously with this editor, of him telling you what works, what doesn't, and suggestions. So it was with a gentleman named Lou Anders, who had just won the Hugo Award for best editor like the month before. And so that's like as hot editor as you can get in the entire, you know, speculative fiction market. Yeah, like the guy just got his Hugo. And after 3 days with Lou in this room, he basically said, like, this book is unpublishable. It's terrible. But you learned how to write. And that is the important thing, because if you hadn't done this, you wouldn't know how to write. So now that you've got this out of your system and you know what to do, go write me a good book. And that sounds like that would be the most crushing, horrible thing in the world. My wife was terrified when I told her that. But I felt so relieved, because I knew that on some fundamental level, but I was so attached to these books that I'd spent, you know, three so more years putting together and writing and honing, that I knew it was bad, but I didn't want to admit it. And I had some ideas for another book that I wanted to do once that was done, this huge 19 volume epic fantasy. Once it's done, I've got this other idea I want to do. And it's like this modern day Monster Hunters and this, you know, this magic revolver and kind of redefining how demonic possession and werewolves and vampires all work. And so I got back from this con fired up, like, I'm going to do it. And I said, I'm going to put these ideas together and I'm going to start that other novel I was talking about. So next week I started writing Dameron, and the first chapter, you know, the original form was exactly 10 pages. And I hit every single point that Lou spent 3 days hammering into our heads of how to start a novel off. And that ended up being the first book that I managed to pitch and sell. And that then led to some more books and some short stories, but it required that I wrote one and most of a second book just to learn how to write. And they're terrible and no one will ever see them.
That's awesome. To your point, like, you write a, you know, 100,000, 120,000 page book. It's especially your first one. Like, it's your baby. It's really hard to be able to accept even constructive criticism about it. And so being able to, like you said, take the good from it and then use that to, you know, springboard yourself into your first publication is really cool and really inspiring. And for me personally, so appreciate you sharing that with us.
Well, what would be a book for those who haven't read your books, Sam, not me, but Sam, which one would you recommend? Dameron, Ashes of Onyx, or Mountain of Daggers to start off with? Seth Scorsese. I don't know how often you get that, dude. We had this conversation before.
It's like, I can't say Skorkowski. I keep saying Scorsese, and I'm like, that's not a.
I'm a mispronounced king myself, and I've also lived my whole life with people butchering my name that I don't even notice anymore. So yeah, you're fine. Well, it kind of depends on what you like. So if you like sword and sorcery short fiction, that's basically full of tropes, that's what Mountain of Daggers is. It is like a checklist of all the sword and sorcery tropes about a thief and these short little adventures that are kind of loosely in a linear story. But it's done like as an ode to Fawford and Gray Mauser and Fritz Leiber and all of those, which a lot of people now, they prefer novels over short fiction, which is cool. But that's what Mountain of Daggers and its sequel are. The Valdican series is demon hunting, modern day action horror stories with a lot of, you know, explosions and gore and fighting and that sort of thing. In each novel in that series, I actually try to do a different theme behind it. Because if I kept writing the same story over and over again, it would kill me. So I tried to make, I tried to change the entire theme of each one to keep them unique and fresh and more fun to write and read. That's actually my most popular is Dameron. That is my most popular by far. Ashes of Onyx is the one I wrote for me. And that is a what we would call a new weird. It's more like it is very hard to pin into a genre, which was a nightmare for selling it because I would have editors say, I have no idea where to classify this book when we're trying to do our classifications in order to sell it. That is the one where we do go into Carcosa, but it's a lot more in the line of like a Clive Barker Portal fantasy, where it does start off and is almost urban fantasy and then just goes nuts. And we start jumping into other worlds, and it will lean into horror. It will lean into this genre and that one as we just kind of do our story, and we're not trying to follow the genre rules. So that's Ashes. But Ashes is also very difficult for a lot of people who say, I want to read an urban fantasy. It's like, well, it's not. It is for the first 100 pages, and then it's definitely not after that. So it's kind of its own thing, because I wrote that one for me, and that's how stuff like A Magica and Great and Secret Show and a lot of the old Barker books would do, where we would start off grounded and then we would enter another realm, and it was fantastical and terrible at the same time. And that was, what I loved. So that's what I did. Mm-hmm. So whichever one of those appeals to you.
So this is an unfair question and might be a little bit asking, like, which child is your favorite? But of all the ones that you've published, do you have a favorite that is, you're the most, that you enjoy the most, or that you enjoyed the most, I guess?
Anasia. That's the second in the Valdigan series.
That one, sorry, go ahead.
No, it's just, Dameron I'm always going to love because it was the first. Warts and all. I mean, I have trouble going through it now because I have so many spots like, I would do this different or I'd do that different sort of thing. Hanassie is what I consider to be like just my favorite. I love that book. Ashes I consider to be under the technical aspect of writing, my best. But Hanassie is my favorite.
Awesome. That one is probably my favorite also, actually. It was kind of cool because I picked it up after Dameron, and I didn't read like the back of it or anything. I just picked it. I really like Dameron, so I'm like, I'm going to read the second one. And so I was, I was expecting another story with Matt, and then you get a different story altogether. And just comparing the two, I really enjoyed it a lot, so really like that one.
At the time I wrote it, I referred to it as pulling a Lestat. If you read Interview with the Vampire, there's you're following Louis and you love Louis, and then there's Lestat, and Lestat's a dick and you hate Lestat. And then the second book's called The Vampire Lestat, and you're like, what, I want to read a book about that dick? And then you read it, and by the time it's done, you're like, man, Lestat's the coolest ever, I love him, and Louis is so whiny, God, I can't stand him. and then everybody loves Lestat, even though in the first book he was a total dick and you hated his guts. So I kind of considered book two pulling a Lestat, because Malcolm in the first book, part one of his roles was he was a conflict character. He caused problems for the hero. Yeah, he wasn't a bad guy. He was a good guy, but he just, he and the hero didn't get along, and he ended up in kind of that antagonistic sort of role. So the second book, we follow him. And I guess if a lot of people, if they're not expecting it, they're like, why do I want to be in the point of view of this jerk? And you realize that his point of view is actually very different. And I ended up loving that book, because the first book, we've got Save the World. And the second book is a very personal story and a very personal horror. And if he dies, he fails, then that's it. That it's not going to destroy the world. It's just him and the people he love, and the rest of the world won't even notice. So I really loved that story.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah, I think that's a great characterization of it too, that the Lestat thing. Because you walked me through kind of my own thoughts through it. Like you said, like Malcolm in the first book, he's confident, you know, he's combative. You don't really love him because you're rooting for Matt, and you're like, Malcolm's kind of a douche. And then you start with the book and you really grow to like the characters you go. So I thought it was great. So jumping, kind of dwelling on, you know, the Valdakin series and with Dameron, what was, if you can point to, you know, one or a couple of things, what was your inspiration when you know, that kind of idea was born? What were your inspirations for it?
There were two. There were actually supposed to be two totally different things. The first was I had the concept that stuff like the monsters out of folklore, you know, werewolves, vampires, all that, instead of it being a virus or all the stuff that we like to use now in popular media because we understand viruses and germs and whatnot, and they treat it that way. If it was an entity and that it was a possession, and when you shoot a werewolf with a silver bullet, you don't actually kill the werewolf. This spirit then just moves to its new host. And all you did was you killed the host, which is really a victim. But it was that's all you did. You made it somebody else's problem. You killed the werewolf. Yay. Now it's taking over someone else far away. And they have to deal with it. But that entity still goes, or a vampire or whatever. And then kind of the idea of what it would take to actually kill that, the actual spirit. The other was I had the idea for this basically magic gun that had a, you know, you had to mold all the bullets because they're of a special caliber, and you had to make them out of silver. And on the bullet, it had like an amen. And on the inside of the barrel was a prayer that would go. And basically, when the bullet traveled down the barrel, and once it went down, would bless this bullet. And that was a separate idea that I had, because I was trying to come up with how you make a magic gun for D&D, because because the gun doesn't hit them, the bullets do. So like, how do you transfer that magic to the bullet itself if you're going to make like a magic gun? And when you put it and you mention them together, it's like, well, it's very clear that those two to go together. No, they're two totally different things I was thinking about. And finally, one day I put them together, like, oh, wow, those fit great. And then from there, the whole concept of the special weapons, and I gave each weapon a very unique properties and whatnot. And I was actually about to start before I discovered there was a French gunsmith by the name of Dumontier who used to make what are called cutlass revolvers, which were these old style percussion cap. Actually, they were more percussion cap. I forget the name. It was one of the earlier types that had a blade on the bottom, like a sword blade that was just slung under the barrel. And a lot of people thought I got that from anime. It's like, no, it's a real gunsmith, real French guy. You can buy Dumontier's. I went ahead and said, like, oh, okay. Then it was a sword that was forged into the gun, which I always knew, but now I kept part of the blade. And I had this French gunsmith from actual history in the 1900s craft this special weapon. And so that's good. A lot of ideas just kind of fell together. There wasn't really a plan when I started of like, I'm going to do this and this and this. It kind of just evolved and morphed, and I took a lot of different things and shoved them together. And Dameron was originally, I think there were three scenes, and the first two chapters were two of those like scenes. And then I had one later on, and it takes place in the middle of the book. No one will ever notice, but those were the three scenes that Dameron came from, is chapter one, chapter two, and a scene in a fight, and they're in a quarry. And I then had to figure out how all those things went together. And that's kind of the writing process.
Cool. That's awesome. I said I wouldn't get super into the... I try to keep this more balanced, but I've just ended up asking you a bunch of writing questions, and I've got one more. Many aspiring writers, myself included, look to your success in the literary world. What advice would you give to those people who aspire to not just write novels, but create compelling RPG scenarios as well, that, like you've done?
Well, with writing novels, because I consider like scenario writing and novel writing two very different skills, very different. So if you're writing fiction, join a writing workshop. It doesn't matter if it's an in-person one, you could do an online one. There are tons of different types, tons of different formats, and tons for every single skill level. And that is how I learned to write. And the big thing that taught me how was by doing critiques, because most of them, in order to get critiques, you have to learn to give critiques. And very often, you were not always the best at taking criticism. You know, that's just a thing. And, you know, a lot of times people would criticize myself like, what do they know? They're fools and I'm a genius. And then I would be critiquing other people and I would find myself saying the same thing that other people had said about my work of like, there's like a lot of repetition in the sentences, or that the styling is this way. And a lot of the craft. And that's when it actually took for me to realize that I did those things too. I was just kind of too stubborn to see it. So join a writing workshop, get some feedback, not from your friend, not from your mom, get it from actual other writers who have rewired their brain to be able to read critically, because that is the only way you're going to improve. If you give your manuscript to your buddy, they're going to love it because they love you, and you're not really going to get good feedback from that. Give it to a stranger who is there to help you and actually knows how to write, and they will give you an honest critique. And the idea is because they're expecting you to give honest critiques back. And I have a lot of friendships that are completely forged by writers who we can be brutally honest with each other. Yeah, we could tear each other's stuff up and then we can laugh and joke and have a drink. But that's the formation of our friendship is over that sort of brutality of honesty, because we're trying to help each other. With a scenario, if you're writing one for publication, one of the big things is play test it. And don't just play test it with your buddies that you wrote it for. Play test it with a group of strangers. But the real test is to then give that to another game master and do not tell them like how to do it. And see if a game master can pick up your adventure, read it, and get it down. And then get feedback from them. What worked? What didn't? What do they suggest? Because a lot of the times what you'll have people do is they'll give it to somebody to play test it, but then they talk them through the whole thing. And it's like, if you're going to sell this, that person that buys this doesn't have the author right there to tell them all the information that you failed to write clearly in there. You know, they need to be able to read that text and they need to be able to run the adventure. And if they have difficulty with the adventure, that's where you know the problem is. And a lot of times when you're trying to do that people accidentally skim over because they told the GM who's going to test it out for them too much. And the GM had like an unfair advantage to give a true honest assessment if it could, you know, does the recipe work?
Right.
So that's my tip.
Cool. Yeah. If you're gonna hand your recipe over to another chef, you can't walk them through, you know, you're handing them the pages, the ingredients. You can't tell them how to make it. Otherwise they're not following the recipe anymore.
Yeah. Don't say like, oh, well, you should whip it this way instead of that way. Like, well, if that's important, you need to write that down in there. Don't give me a verbal tip. It needs to be in the recipe.
You Bob Ross them and you're like, now let's add a pretty little tree over here.
Yeah. It's like, you know, just don't give them a bunch of friendly advice on how to run it better that isn't in there. Because your customer doesn't get that. They don't have you on speed dial.
Well, that's really good advice.
Yeah, you probably don't want to sell something like that.
Don't bother.
You're like, here's my cell phone number in the back if you have any questions.
According to legend, Gary Gygax would actually get regular phone calls from fans over that type of stuff. Like, you know, Mr. Gygax, we have a question about the Beholder. And, you know, he's just answering it on the phone. It was the 70s and time was weird. So
that shows, that's how you know somebody loves their craft, right?
I don't love my craft that much, man. I'm not giving him my phone number to ask me questions.
Well, you do a lot of skits on your show. Out of all the characters you do, which one's your favorite to play?
Jack?
Yeah.
Jack the NPC in his many, 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 many stupid costumes. I enjoy doing that. After that, I enjoy Todd. I enjoy Dweebles the least. I hate doing Dweebles because I hate doing my hair that way.
That's awesome. I saw you played a woman in one of your skits. How do you enter that headspace to play a woman?
Well, I steal some bra from my wife, and then I load it with socks. And that's about it. Because when I play a woman in those, it's Jack in the role of a woman, and Jack's voice is always consistent. So it doesn't matter if he's a man or a woman, or of, you know, we're doing an ancient, you know, Chinese wuxia game, or we're doing far future sci-fi, and he's got a wolf head. His voice is always the same. It is always clearly Jack the whole time, whether he is, you know, in a dress or not. So, no real difference in the headspace, because the headspace is just Jack. Jack is delivering this. He just might happen to be dressed like a woman because that's just the role he ended up in.
Jack, there you go.
Your voices are always super good, super on point, super hilarious. How much of that is trial and error and just practice? And is there any of that that's like kind of your background? You mentioned like you got your degree in broadcasting and radio and those types of things. How much did you pick up from that? And how much it is just, you know, trial and error and having fun with it?
Oh, it's almost all trial and error. When I was doing my degree, there were more focused on the technical aspect. Well, at the time, man, I learned how to do audio on reel-to-reel tapes. It was outdated at the time. They were charging me out the butt to learn how to do reel-to-reel tapes. So none of the stuff that I really learned actually translates. I had to do linear editing, where you actually had to edit in order of how it's going to play. And, you know, on my computer, I can do nonlinear editing and then insert little scenes, clips here and there, and that sort of deal. So it's nothing really translated over. Everything else has just been trial and error. And a lot of times I have to do like 5-6 takes of just about any line, and then figure out which is the one that I said the inflection the best while also not muddling my lines. Because, you know, a lot of times the inflection was that everything was perfect. The face, everything was great, but then I flubbed the line. Okay, well, I'll go with my sixth choice because that's the only one I got the line all the way out. So it's just kind of figuring it out that way. And just, I think the black and white filters and the kind of the cartoony nature of their voice really do kind of trick people into thinking I am better than I am when it comes to my acting ability. Because if you throw on a fake mustache, a black and white filter, and like a drawl, people somehow forget that it's literally you. Somehow.
Acting's hard. And when I first DM'd my second game where I was actually doing NPCs, I couldn't keep my accent straight. I was gave everybody the same accent or a different accent every single time. I just gave up halfway through and just did my regular voice because it's just the worst trying to do a character voice the entire time.
Unless it's over the top, I can't do it either. Like accents, oh man, they all end up becoming some sort of Irish Australian something, something. Or they're very cartoony. You know, it's like my French voice sounds like I'm trying to be Pepe Le Pew. It's like, no, that's just what it sounds like. Yeah. In order to make me consistently remember it. You know, if I want to do like a German accent, I sound like Sergeant Schultz from Hogan's Heroes. I mean, that's it. That's the extent of my acting range is these cartoony extremes in order to keep it straight. Otherwise, if I try to do subtle, it just kind of blends into this one accent that isn't anything. It's just kind of a blending of it all into some incomprehensible thing. So like I've also only got a couple NPC voices that I actually can consistently do. And then I might come in up with an over the top one that then becomes resigned to this one NPC till the end of time. Mm-hmm. So which means all bartenders in my world sound pretty much the exact same. Yeah, I just... Yeah, just all of them. Every D&D, every Call of Cthulhu Bartender, all of them in the far future, they all pretty much sound the same. That's like the patented Seth Bartender voice, which my players know would love because they make fun of me for it.
That's awesome.
It's part of their job as the players.
That makes so much sense. My most outrageous character, Reginald America, is just over the top, super American, and it's the only one I can do consistently.
Yeah. And a lot of the times it's like the only way you can remember it is to be just so stupid with it. That's once again, people are like, do you have a serious game? Like, you know, I would have, except for the fact that the only, like, everybody has the same voice except for this one dude that's based off Macho Man Randy Savage. And, you know, but yeah, totally serious.
Yeah. I was a paladin dragon and my name was Drandy Savage.
That's pretty much all of them.
That's it.
All right. Well, I think we've taken up a full hour of your time. Really appreciate it, Seth. Really enjoyed the conversation. Love having you on. Before we let you go, is there anything you're working on right now? Anything new you want us to highlight?
The time being, no. I've got a few things in the pipe, but I'm not allowed to talk about them until publishers make announcements. So, you know, I do have a few things, but you know, you can find my books and all that on Amazon, Audible, because I'm an audiobook addict. I insisted that every book that I do is an audio edition. And then Dameron Hanassier were finalists for best supernatural audiobooks the years they came out, because I got R.C. Bray somehow, and he is fantastic.
He is, yeah.
Then there's a Modern Mythos podcast I do with Sean Hook, where it's mostly just two old keepers just BSing for an hour. That's pretty much the format. nothing horribly detailed, except for just two old GMs just kind of shooting the crap for like 1 or 2 hours, because we can't even remember how long we're supposed to go. Then of course my channel, Seth Skorkowski, which is not a catchy name, but it was originally meant to promote my writing, so I didn't want to have a cool gamer name to it because I wanted my name attached to it, my very long, unpronounceable, difficult to spell name, which clearly a brilliant move on my part. But once you know how to spell my name, you can find all my stuff.
Which, by the way, I wish I would have found your channel when I was DMing and learning all this stuff, because it would have made my life so much easier. Because I think I looked through all your 7 Deadly Sin videos and I made every single one of them.
I've made all of them too. All right, that's part of the shtick, is I have made all of these. Sometimes many times have I committed that same sin. Because I'm not necessarily the smartest guy to realize why things aren't working.
Well, you're in good company. But yeah, I'd recommend that to any of our listeners. Go watch his channel, because if you want to DM, if you want to get into this stuff, he has very helpful tips and things to go off of. So I highly recommend that.
All right. All of us, I think, feel the same way. Seth, thanks again for joining us. We've loved having you on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Arkham Files dossier series. We want to thank our special guest, Seth Skorkowski, for joining us once again. That was a ton of fun, and encourage all of you to subscribe to Seth's YouTube channel and buy his books. You will not regret it. Keep an ear out for more interviews with us in the future, but also for the return of our regular case file. Our current case is The Radio Man. If you haven't checked that out yet, you are missing out. It is a great blend of supernatural, mythos creepiness, and good old-fashioned murder investigation. So check that out. Check out our website, www.arkhamrpg.com. And until next time, stay sane.
Hold up.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.